Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In the room with Bin Laden, a woman, Bin Laden's wife, rushed the U.S. assaulter and was shot in the leg but not killed. Bin Laden was then shot and killed. He was not armed.
The killing of Osama bin Laden, version 1.2. That was White House spokesman Jay Carney yesterday. A little different from what U.S. counterterror chief John Brennan said Monday about bin Laden being armed and using a woman as a human shield. CIA Director Leon Panetta also revised the story a bit from the original version that the mission was to either kill him or capture him.
The authority here was to kill bin Laden. And obviously under their rules of engagement, if he had in fact thrown up his hands, surrendered, and didn't appear to be represent any kind of threat, then they were to capture him. But they had full authority to kill him.
So we begin today with the meaning of the changing story and as much clarity as we can get to on whether enhanced interrogation or torture, if you prefer, or the CIA secret prisons in other countries may have helped them get bin Laden or whether that is being exaggerated. With us for this is Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at NYU. We covered some of these same topics with Karen in our online chat at noon yesterday on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. So thanks to some of you listening today who joined us for that. Now we're going to bring that same conversation onto the air. So Karen Greenberg, thank you for doing this and welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be back.
First on the changing story, is this an evolving understanding by the White House itself after a murky situation? Is this a lie or cover-up that they decided not to go to the mat with, and so they're telling us the truth? Or what made these details change, as far as you could tell?
It's probably a mixture of all of those things, although I think that saying it's a lie or a cover-up sort of misses the mark. I don't think there's anything nefarious yet going on here, but I think that it takes, I think there was probably a decision made about what to say and when to say it, and that changed. And the reason is that the killing of bin Laden is not a minor moment, as you know we discussed yesterday and as so many pundits and politicians are talking about this week. And in absorbing it and what it means, it takes some time. And I think that affects the kind of details that the administration wants to release. In addition to which, I think there's always some kind of confusion about what really happened. Because you can imagine the amount of different informational feeds that began to roll out immediately after his killing.
Indeed. But there's a long history of the U.S. and other governments puffing up stories of war for propaganda purposes. Remember the rescue of U.S. soldier Jessica Lynch at the beginning of the Iraq War, who became the darling of America when the war was young and becoming controversial? That turned out to be largely exaggerated or made up. The Kuwaiti incubator baby hoax that helped the U.S. government sell the first Gulf War in 1991 about Iraqi troops throwing babies in an incubator on the cold floor to die after they invaded Kuwait never happened, made up with the help of a U.S. public relations firm. Is there a historical pattern, and does this fit?
No. I mean, there is a historical pattern. You got that right. But this is bin Laden. It's a very different thing, and at least in my opinion, I'm sure you could have listeners who disagree, but it's hard to imagine hyping up the killing of bin Laden. And while issues about, you know, using human shields, et cetera, may come out in the wash and may have been rumors at the beginning, the actual reality of what happened should be not just the headline but the story, I think.
How do they get something like that wrong? How does it come out of the mouth of the Obama administration's counterterrorism director, Brennan? In one way, bin Laden was armed, and out of the mouth of the White House spokesman differently the next day?
It's a really good question, and it's unsettling, and you'd like to think that they would have their act together. This is a message government. They're so ahead of the message all the time. They tell us a year ahead of time that they're going to, you know, embrace indefinite detention before they even roll it out as a policy. So it's a very good question. My guess is they had a narrative they were gonna, that they thought they were going to stick to that they wrote ahead of time. and that as the facts became clear and were different, and they probably realized in this day and age they couldn't hold them as tight and as secretly as they would have liked to, they felt some kind of safety or necessity of telling us what we think or the actual details. But again, I credit it all to the fact that this is a game changer, and therefore maybe different kind of information can be released and in a more comfortable way, and that to think that you have to make up narratives or embrace the the most lethal narrative you can find may not be the way we have to look going forward. So I'm taking this as a positive sign.
Karen Greenberg from NYU Center on Law and Security. Listeners, this conversation, as always, includes all of us. So if you want to say or ask anything about the changing story, about whether they should release photos of bin Laden's body, we'll get to that, about the role of torture or enhanced interrogation, if you prefer, of detainees leading to information or not leading to information. We'll try to clarify that. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And let's jump right in with Michael in Manhattan. Michael, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. I'm calling because I'm a little disappointed. I think there are bigger issues to debate. The fact is that the FBI's most wanted has been found and killed. The President of the United States stood up, you know, less than 6 hours before this mission was going on and handled himself cool and collect. Why the media and why we are focusing on the nuances and the details and the specifics of who pulled the trigger, why did they say it was in self-defense, how come this, how come that, I think is taking away from what in fact occurred, and why we put so much energy into it is so disappointing to me, because I think the media is mediaizing something that shouldn't be. The fact is, you know, these guys, why the term game changer and make up a narrative? I mean, you saw these guys sitting in that Situation Room watching what seemed to be, unless the presumption is that they were making up all those faces and the covering of their mouth.
Right.
They
and
were
I think when Karen Greenberg says game changer, she's making your point that this is the capture of Osama bin Laden, the killing of Osama bin Laden that we're talking about. This is the real game changer. But, Michael, if it wasn't bin Laden, would it matter to you, some of these details and changing stories, to the underlying legal or moral debates that we always have about shooting to kill rather than arresting if you can, about returning a body to a family, about the sovereignty of a nation to decide whether a U.S. invasion takes place inside its borders?
You know, Brian, you had a speaker on the other day who was a military, I think he was a SEAL, I'm not sure, who captured the essence of it so well when he said, look, this is a war and it's been a war. This man, it's a different kind of war than World War II. It's a different kind of war than Vietnam. And everybody seems to lose sight of that. And this guy is the mastermind behind that war. And as the mastermind behind that war, if Hitler was in a bunker and we had SEALs, we would have gone in and taken the guy out. And the fact is that Osama has been preaching a doctrine of war, and we went to war against him. So I don't liken it, similar to your speaker the other day or your caller the other day. I don't liken it to, okay, maybe we should. And then you had another one.
I understand. Michael, I'm going to go just for time purposes, but I really appreciate your points, and you make important points. And Karen Greenberg, you know, I was going to bring up the Hitler analogy, too. Would we be having this discussion if in the middle of World War II they found Hitler and they just took him out? Would anybody be talking about whether he was armed or any of this other stuff? And are they equivalent?
They are equivalent, and I agree in essence with much of what that caller said, as I think you tried to point out to him. I think bin Laden is in a different category. I think if you really sit down and think about this from a political point of view as well as the a national security point of view, this was the right move. What might be discomforting to many people is the later statements by Hillary Clinton and others that this proves that we have to pursue our counterterrorism policy in this way going forward. I'm not sure exactly what she meant, but how much of this does this open up, sort of a green light for similar kinds of actions?
Right.
I think Osama bin Laden is in his own category, and I think the reference to Hitler is correct. And the only thing I think that's really clear here is that wouldn't it have been nice if this could have happened much earlier? It took a long time.
And I would just add that in terms of why we mediaize it, as he called it, at least from my perspective, we have to be more than stenographers in the media when the White House, after a game-changing event like the killing of Osama bin Laden, makes directly contradictory statements on two consecutive days. That doesn't mean that we don't come to the conclusion that it's no big deal in the scheme of things, because getting bin Laden is just so huge and that all this stuff is morally justified. Maybe we come to that conclusion. But when the White House makes directly contradictory statements about the condition under which that happened on two consecutive days, we can't just be stenographers. We have to at least ask the questions and have the clarifying conversations like this one.
Absolutely. And something that caller said that was interesting was that, you know, we all watch them watching the event. Well, it seems to me that that's interesting because then they reported on the event in two different ways. But they were watching it. It wasn't just from reports.
Right. And he's talking about the photo of the president and others in the Situation Room while it was going on. And that, of course, was a photo op.
Right.
Again, not to say that it wasn't reflecting something really genuine about the president of the United States at an unbelievably historic moment like that, but they chose to let photographers in to the Situation Room, which doesn't happen every day, let me tell you, because they wanted you to see them like that, and they dressed for the occasion, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, again, not to take away from the gravity of it, the immensity of it, the genuineness of it, but there's also media management going on here. I want to change the topic and talk about torture. And I think maybe in an opposite way, the media has jumped in general too quickly to a debate about whether torture of detainees was more justifiable than we may have thought it was if it led us to bin Laden, when the media hasn't really parsed if, in fact, this happened. So, Karen, this is a lot of what we talked about online yesterday in our online chat. Let's try to get to the actual facts of who were the people who were allegedly tortured along the way among the detainees, and is anybody asserting that they gave up any information that led to the courier that led us to bin Laden?
Actually, it seems to be quite the opposite. It seems that the people that originally were pointed to, including KSM, who had been tortured, giving leads was precisely the opposite. They never revealed this information, despite 183 waterboardings. And it was, in fact, the detainees who were interrogated without enhanced interrogation techniques who helped them find the path to bin Laden. I guess you can't have it both ways, which is what I think the members of the Bush administration have decided to revive the torture debate. Find it quite distasteful and against the facts, and yet it seems to be getting some traction.
Some of the facts, at least as reported in mainstream news organizations, seem to cast serious question on whether torture or enhanced interrogation was really relevant here. I'm going to read two paragraphs from today's New York Times article on this. Glenn Carl, a retired CIA officer who oversaw the interrogation of a high-level detainee in 2002, said in a phone interview Tuesday that coercive techniques, quote, didn't provide useful, meaningful, trustworthy information. He said that while some of his colleagues defended the measures, everyone was deeply concerned and most felt it was un-American and did not work. Now, with respect to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, again reading from the Times, according to an American official familiar with his interrogation, Mr. Mohammed was first asked about Mr. Kuwaiti, the courier, in the fall of 2003, months after the waterboarding. Again, months after the waterboarding. He acknowledged having known him, but said the courier was retired and of little significance. In 2004, however, a Qaeda operative named Hassan Ghul, captured in Iraq, gave a different account of Mr. Kuwaiti, according to the American official. Mr. Ghul told interrogators that Mr. Kuwaiti was a trusted courier who was close to bin Laden. The details of Mr. Ghul's treatment are unclear. The CIA says he was not waterboarded. So when you put all those various pieces together, and I realize that's, you know, a lot of detail to take in all at once, it doesn't sound like there was any relationship between any moment of, aha, I'm only going to stop torturing you if you tell us the truth, and then all of a sudden the truth comes out.
That's correct. But there's also something else here, you know, which is focusing on the detainees is one thing. I am pretty sure, and I hope, that we had other sources of information from the region and from our intelligence services that coordinated domestically and internationally to find these people and to find the courier. And so I think that putting it all on, you know, focusing it on Guantanamo and then trying to focus it on torture is sort of, again, a script that could have been written well ahead of time, but not one that may be relevant. And this is kind of story that the intelligence service, the CIA, and others are not going to tell us. And probably for good reason, because how they got their information outside of Guantanamo is very probably very complicated and probably within a lot of legal gray areas, which is what covert operations are about. And so the focus on Guantanamo takes the focus off of what actually may have happened.
And there were two instances. I shouldn't say two instances. I should say that the Times reports both yesterday and today are that KSM and another detainee, Al-Libi, seem to confirm the importance of this courier by denying that he was important. And they already knew that he was somebody. And so when they denied, they already knew that he was important, and they already knew that they knew him, these detainees. So when they denied that he was some importance, of some importance, there was a logical deduction that the interrogators were able to make. That seems to be the story.
Yeah,
but torture couldn't bring about something like that.
No. Well, torture apparently brought out what you're saying is leaving out the story. But I think it's a weird way. You say this is rational. This is not a way to this is not a logical. How many things, everything they left out or everything they denied is something we would follow because we think because they denied it or left it out, it's valuable. That seems to me proof that the use of our interrogation techniques would take us 10 years to figure out what kind of information was useful or not, because the world of what they deny and what they don't say is indefinite. You know, it's infinite. And so it can't be that, oh, they left these two things out or they didn't corroborate it, and that's how we found these people. It's just, I don't understand how that is a logical narrative.
Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at NYU, and Samir in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hello, Samir.
Yeah, hi, Brian. I have something to give you which nobody knows. And this is from a very reliable source. My brother is a top doctor in one of the hospitals, in the only hospital in Ahmedabad. And I called him, and most probably I'll call you tomorrow and give you the whole thing about the fact that he's treating the family members of Osama, and they're giving him information which nobody knows. And the thing that I do know right now today is the fact that before this happened, the Pakistani army, which has a garrison right there, told all the folks living in Ahmedabad to shut their lights out and don't come out of their house before the raid happened. And once the raid was underway, so this notion that the Pakistani army, the Pakistani ISI didn't know about this fact is wrong. Because the CIA is giving us wrong information right now.
This is according to your brother, you say, who's a surgeon in Abbottabad who's treating bin Laden family members?
Right, right. And that information, what exactly happened inside the house, I can call you tomorrow and give you. But the fact that we know right now that both the Pakistanis and these Americans are saying that they did not disclose this information to the Pakistanis because they might leak the information is not true at all.
Samir, I'm putting you on hold, and if you want to tell us anything else, my producer is going to pick up, and you can talk to her off the air. And Karen Greenberg, obviously, this is a caller who I don't know. We cannot vouch for or confirm any of that information. So I think we just kind of have to leave it as something somebody says for the moment and see if we can pick up a thread from him off the air that we could actually follow. There is a report from WikiLeaks via the Guardian of London, and later in the program we're going to be talking to Julian Assange's attorney and asking him about this, but I wonder if you've seen it, that a WikiLeaks document released just last week gave information that would tip off, and I guess this was a U.S. State Department document from that big cache from 2008, that could have tipped off bin Laden to the fact that the U.S. knew where he was and thereby forced the U.S. to rush up this operation. Have you?
Somebody reported that last week, actually. I forget where I read it, but yeah, I read it in at least two places. Again, I don't think we're going to know the magnitude of this story or the details of the story for a long time. And the caveat I issue here in terms of trying to find it out this close to the event is, if you can remember after 9/11, how many different stories about who knew what when and, you know, what the sequence of events was. And it took a very long time to figure it out with any kind of clarity and reliability. And I think it's a similar situation here. We just don't know. Mm-hmm. And we can take all of these facts together. Ultimately, this is going to depend in part on the government and what they're willing to tell us.
And we will talk to Julian Assange's lawyer about that WikiLeaks release, as I said, later in the program. There's one other issue here, and that is the photo, and I just want to touch on that before we go. Photos of bin Laden's body, which, you know, again, as described to the Times by an unnamed U.S. government official, it looks like him covered in blood with a hole in his head.
Yeah.
Not a pretty thought. But do you think it's important that the photo be released or not be released, or either, as they're apparently debating in the White House right now?
Actually, I'm of two minds about this photo. I, you know, of course, would like to see it, and I'm not sure exactly why I've always said we should see the images of torture. And I just think the more you know, the better. On the other hand, I think that there is some sort of violation involved that offends me. I also have been deeply disturbed by the celebratory response to his death. While I think that we live in a safer world and that his capture or killing has been necessary and important and essential since 9/11, and as I said, it's a game changer, I'm worried, and I'm sure they are in the White House, about what kind of celebration would go on around that. And that, to me, is deeply disturbing, and I would probably rather avoid that moment than have it played out before us.
Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at NYU, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And listeners, you can keep this conversation going, obviously, on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. We'll have different aspects on the air as we go along here as well, including Julian Assange's lawyer later on. Next, we're going to take your phone calls. If you have ever been part of a group chanting USA, USA, people are debating that as well. And perhaps you were among the hundreds of New Yorkers who traveled to Ground Zero after hearing the news of Osama bin Laden's death on Sunday night. Perhaps you're one of those people who called us over the last couple of days to say you were kind of grossed out by people chanting USA, USA at a moment like this or during war. So let's ask the question. When you chant USA, USA, what are you actually saying? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Now, while your calls are coming in, one tiny footnote to the killing of Osama bin Laden. Some of you know my long, bizarre history of being on vacation when some of the most memorable news stories of our time take place, especially ones that involve in-your-face attacks. This goes way back to the first year of the show when during my very first summer vacation, Iraq invaded Kuwait, which basically started the first Gulf War. Later, I was on vacation when the Clinton administration invaded the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, and raided that Cuban kid, Elian Gonzalez's hideout in Florida. I was on vacation when al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, and when the U.S. retaliated with cruise missiles into Afghanistan and Sudan. They almost got bin Laden then, or tried to. I was on a three-day weekend when the U.S. captured Saddam Hussein in 2004. And yes, folks, as some of you may have realized, I was supposed to be off on Monday of this week when they killed Osama bin Laden. That day off got canceled around midnight Sunday night. Thanks to guest host Jamie Floyd for understanding. She'll be here next Monday instead. Maybe canceling a vacation day will break the curse. But in the meantime, whenever you notice I'm not here, it may be a good day to lay a little low. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. When we come back, we'll take your calls on why you chant USA, USA, and what it means to you.